This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Last week, a violent insurrection by pro-Trump extremists at the U.S. Capitol targeted members of Congress. It left five dead and dozens of police officers injured. With President Trump digging in on his false claims of a stolen election, there are reports of plans for round two in the coming weeks. An ABC News Ipsos poll released Sunday found 56% of Americans want him removed before his term ends on January 20th. But calls for Trump to resign are going nowhere, and plans for removing him from office are questionable in a divided Congress. With us to talk about what's next is someone who was at the Capitol last Wednesday. Senator Tina Smith is a Democrat from Minnesota. Senator Smith, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jen. It's great to be with you.
And I should note that we invited every Republican senator to join our program this morning. They all either declined or did not respond, but the invitation still stands. Senator, we know a growing list of those who stormed the Capitol are being charged with crime. But for those who incited the violence, what does accountability look like to you?
Well, the key word is accountability, Jen. And if there's all this talk right now about how do we move forward, shouldn't we just move forward? But the only way that we can move forward, I'm convinced, is if we hold accountable those who not only participated in this riot, this attempted coup and insurrection, but also those that incited it, that were collaborators and enablers. And I count among them that group, members of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate, who helped to tell the big lie that President Trump has been telling for so many months, that this election was stolen. And the second big lie that Vice President Pence and members of Congress could undo the election and the will of the people, which, of course, is not true either.
You've called for Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley to resign. If they don't, do you think the Senate should kick them out?
I do. I think that we should look at all of our tools for holding these individuals accountable. And let's be honest, there are quite a few of them. The Senate has an ethics committee, which is a bipartisan committee, and I think that the ethics committee needs to do its job. There's also opportunities for censure as well. What I hope happens after this moment, really this long moment in our country where there has been so much division and so much walking away from facts, that the Senate can come together around a shared group of facts about what happened here and that we can act in a bipartisan way. And it's really interesting to me as you see the shifts in this way that this is being talked about amongst all sorts of constituencies of the Republican Party, that, you know, I hope we're going to be able to get to a place where Democrats and Republicans can actually talk about this issue based on the facts and not just based on partisan differences.
Well, as I said, you've called for Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley to resign. Who else specifically do you think needs to be held to account?
Well, think about the reality that the House Minority Leader voted to undo the results of a free and fair election. Think about what that means in our country and the walking away from our institutions and our norms that that represents. You know, I read last week somebody wise said that democracy depends on at least two political parties who are committed to the norms and the laws and that know how to win, but also know how to lose. And if you don't have that, then democracy doesn't work.
And you're talking about House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy there. The House is planning to introduce articles of impeachment against President Trump on Wednesday if Vice President Pence does not activate the 25th Amendment process for removal. But outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said the Senate likely wouldn't pick it up until January 19th at the earliest, the day before Trump leaves office. Should the Senate still pursue an impeachment trial even after Trump is out of office?
Well, if the U.S. House of Representatives impeaches the president and sends the Senate articles of impeachment, the U.S. Senate has no choice but to take up those articles and to basically make a decision about whether to convict or not to convict. I think it's really remarkable. You said at the beginning how many Americans now believe that the president should not be in office. And I certainly share that view. I mean, I believe that this individual remains a danger to our democracy and to our public safety and to our national security up until the very moment that he leaves office. So I think that Speaker Pelosi is doing the right thing to call on the vice president to to activate the 25th Amendment. Isn't it amazing that the vice president said something like he was going to wait until he felt that the president had become even more unstable? Which is, doesn't that put a catch in your throat as you think about the place that we're in right now? And of course, this is all happening in the context of people seeing even more online activity of those who are planning and are being incited to come to Washington again on the 19th and 20th of January, when we will be inaugurating the next president and vice president of the United States.
We're talking to Senator Tina Smith, a Democrat from Minnesota. And again, I should note that we invited every Republican senator to join our program this morning. They all either declined or did not respond, but the invitation stands. I want to read you this tweet we got from Karen, who says, "Don't play revenge politics. Don't make villains out of every Republican. Build bridges and realize everything can be undone at midterms if everyone hates the Democratic agenda." And a number of your colleagues, Senator, worry that continuing an impeachment after Trump is out of office would be a distraction from confirming Biden's nominees at the start of his term. Where do you stand on that question?
Well, I think that appreciate what Karen is saying, but I don't actually believe that that is the question. If what we are asking ourselves is this an eye for an eye? You know, you did this to me, therefore I'm going to do that to you. I don't believe in that. That is not part of my faith. That's not part of the way I think about solving problems. But to me, the underlying question is one of accountability. If we have individuals, starting with the president and including some of my colleagues, who incite a riot and an insurrection against the government, they storm the United States Capitol, people die. We have damage. And truly, some of my colleagues literally thought that they were experiencing their last day. And there is no accountability for that. Then that undercuts the idea that we are actually a nation of rules and laws. And we cannot allow that to happen. And especially when you think, to me, this is so crucial. The people that stormed our Capitol were, for the most part, white people waving flags, Confederate flags. They literally installed a gallows on the grounds of the United States Capitol. And there has to be accountability for that in a world where we see black and brown people treated by law enforcement in such dramatically different ways.
That raises this question for me. To your mind, were Wednesday's events about President Trump in particular, or is this about a more fundamental schism in the U.S.? We've long been warned by national security experts that white domestic extremism is the biggest threat this nation faces right now domestically.
Yes. I think that is absolutely right. What we saw on Wednesday, I believe, was domestic terrorism. Now, there were many things happening on Wednesday, and there were many people there. Not all of them had one sole motivation, one sole goal. But it, I believe, represents and was a window into the realities of domestic terrorism and white supremacy that is a dire threat to our country. And we cannot look away from that. And that is what I mean by accountability. You know, I support the idea that we need to create a 9/11 style look at what happened here, really specifically looking at the issue of domestic terrorism to truly understand what caused this and what we can do about it. And we cannot look away from this. You know, it all starts with the lies. And if we don't dig into that, we won't ever be able to move forward.
Senator, I'm really curious about the conversations you're having with your Senate colleagues right now about the path forward and what kind of appetite there is right now for bipartisanship among Senate Democrats.
Yeah, well, I detect a huge appetite for bipartisanship, and I know that there's many of us, I share this, I believe this, that you know, often you have a moment of crisis that creates a moment also of sort of catharsis where you say, wow, like we are so off track. We have got to be able to figure out how to come together and rise to a higher calling. Now, I am always an optimist, and I've been in the Senate for only 3 years. I I believe in public service, and I see that belief shared by colleagues on both sides of the aisle. And isn't that what America needs right now? I mean, we are in the midst of, I think, you know, the greatest crisis in our country since the Civil War, a crisis of public health and of economic opportunity, the COVID crisis, a crisis of racial equity. It is a moment for us to come together, and Vice President Biden, soon to be President Biden, is ready to lead us there. I mean,
is that appetite shared by Republicans?
I believe that it is shared by Republicans, and I've had conversations with some of my Republican colleagues just in the last few days, where they are also they're expressing the same view. I'm not naive. I mean, let's be honest. Mitch McConnell, and it is too bad we don't have members of the Republican Party on today, but Mitch McConnell has been the greatest obstructor of legislative progress that I think we've ever seen in my lifetime in the United States Senate. So I'm grateful that we may have the opportunity to actually move forward and do some things in a bipartisan basis.
We've been talking to Senator Tina Smith. She's a Democrat from Minnesota. Senator, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you, Jen.
And we got this tweet from Barbara who says, I want Trump out, whether it's by 25th Amendment or impeachment. I don't care. He needs to be held accountable for his role in the attack on the Capitol. And again, I should note that we invited every Republican senator to join our program this morning. They all either declined or did not respond, but the invitation stands. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. Last week, a violent mob of Trump supporters incited by the president overtook the U.S. Capitol. Today, we're talking about how Congress is responding and what might happen next.
Here's the truth. The president caused this. The president is unfit, and the president is unwell. And the president must now relinquish control of the executive branch voluntarily or involuntarily.
So I think the president did commit impeachable offenses. There's a little doubt in my mind about that. I don't know as a practical matter that it is actually even possible to do an impeachment in the handful of days that are left.
The Democrats have chosen to use this as an opportunity to talk about ridiculous things like let's impeach a president who isn't going to be even in office in about 9 days.
Now, my personal view is that the president touched the hot stove on Wednesday and is unlikely to touch it again. We should be thinking more about the first day mm-hmm. of the next presidency than the last day of his presidency, in my view.
Well, I like the 25th Amendment because it gets rid of him. He's out of office. But there is strong support in the Congress for impeaching the president a second time.
That was Republican Representative Adam Kinzinger, followed by Republican Senators Pat Toomey, Marco Rubio, and Roy Blunt, and you heard House Speaker Nancy Pelosi last. With us to help make sense of all of it is Grace Seegers. She's a political reporter for CBS News who was at the Capitol last Wednesday. Grace, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Alexandra Jaffe. She's a national political correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back to 1A, Alexandra.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And Ned Foley. He's the director of election law at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Ned, it's great to have you with us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
And we also want to hear from you. What do you think Congress should do now? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Grace, it's been a few days since the insurrection. How are you thinking about it now?
Well, it's kind of interesting because in the moment on Wednesday, I didn't really realize how serious this was. And with every passing day, as we get more information, I realize how truly close we were to the situation, which was already so terrifying, being much, much worse. I was just reading through my notes from Wednesday yesterday, and I realized that the protesters, the rioters, were already in the Capitol by the time I was getting into the Senate chamber, and the Senate chamber was locked down, which at the time I didn't realize. But with every day that there's more information, it's just really stunning to me how close we got to it being so much worse. And in the moment, no one really even knew what was going on.
Well, Alexandra, you were listening along to our conversation with Senator Smith. Any big takeaways from what we heard there?
Yeah, I have to say, in talking with Democrats, listening to Senator Smith, one maybe silver lining out of what's been a very difficult week for D.C. and the nation is this idea that it may foster more bipartisan cooperation in the new Congress. I mean, Senator Smith mentioned this. I heard this from Amy Klobuchar this weekend. Democrats have been saying that they're hearing more enthusiasm from their Republican colleagues and just more openness to bipartisanship and a general sense that they need to bring the temperature down on Capitol Hill. And so, you know, although it's a difficult time for the nation and obviously a lot needs to be done to figure out what exactly happened and how to hold people accountable for that, I think in the new Congress, we may be able to see the sort of shift back towards a normal working order and maybe more bipartisan action on things like COVID relief that we haven't really been able to see in the past 4 years of the Trump administration.
But is some of this just a practical matter in that power has shifted in Congress?
Absolutely. I mean, Democrats are now going to have, you know, very slim control over the Senate, and so they'll be able to call a lot of the shots. But we could have still seen a lot of Republicans resisting President Biden's presidency. I mean, we saw that last week on Wednesday. But what I've been hearing is that Republicans are less enthusiastic about that obstruction. They are more looking towards working with Democrats. They, again, want to really bring down that temperature. And so I think you'll see Donald Trump's hold over the GOP continue to weaken. We've already seen some of that since a number of Republicans have come out and denounced him. And I think that that will help quite a bit getting things back to normal on Capitol Hill.
Ned, same question to you. You were listening along. Did anything stand out to you from the senator?
Yes, I think that point about bipartisanship is key because America needs a healthy system of electoral competition, political competition. And, you know, for structural reasons, we have essentially a two-party system compared to Europe that has multi-parties. And if only one of the two parties kind of believes in the rules and fair play, and as the senator said, you know, an essential part of that is the willingness to lose an election and to admit defeat. And that's the pathology that happened this time. You know, President Trump refused to admit defeat and then perpetrated the lie that we're calling the big lie, that it was all fraud. And the party as a whole got caught up in it. It wasn't just him as one candidate. Others went along. And that's a real sickness on our system. And so how do we get healthy? And I think, you know, the definition of healthy is that both parties, you know, again, believe in the rules and play by the rules. Whichever party you're a member of, the other party has to exist for overall freedom and fairness to exist. And so rebuilding, somebody said the word normal, I think the senator did. We've got to get back to normal, healthy competition. And hopefully that's done in a bipartisan spirit, because I don't think one party can impose it on the other.
Well, the senator also talked a lot about accountability. And we got this message from Aaron on Facebook, who says there have to be real consequences for what happened at the Capitol. The idea of looking forward, not back, is what got us to this place. And Ned, at this point, Democrats in Congress are focused on pushing for invoking the 25th Amendment before impeachment. Explain how the 25th Amendment works.
Sure, it's a little bit complicated, but I think it's exactly right to start there because, you know, analytically, we should distinguish sort of between now and January 20th as one period of time and then what happens after January 20th. And I share the concern of the senator and Speaker Pelosi that we are in a dangerous moment with an unstable President Trump still in command of the nuclear codes. And the 25th Amendment is really designed for that type of problem, is when there's an illness or sickness in the presidency that disables the president from serving in office. Now, normally that's, you know, a coma or physical incapacitation. It could be senility like Alzheimer's disease, but it could be psychiatric. But whatever the medical precondition is, if the vice president and the majority of the cabinet believe the medical prerequisite is there, they're entitled to take power away from the incapacitated president, put the power in the hands of the vice president for as long as the incapacity remains, which would be, you know, functionally where we are now until January 20th. So I think that's the constitutional tool to deal with the immediate emergency. After January 20th, we could talk about accountability, and I do believe in accountability, but that's a different question in how to go about that.
Grace, how likely is it that this route would succeed? Do we know if Pence or other cabinet members support it? And we know two members of the cabinet have resigned.
Yes, I don't think that it is very likely we will see the 25th Amendment invoked. So today, Speaker Pelosi is bringing to the floor that resolution that is calling on Pence to formally invoke the 25th Amendment and giving him 24 hours to say if he will do so. I don't think we've seen any indication that he is willing to do so. And as you said, two cabinet members have resigned. And while they were critical of President Trump, it appears to me as if they resigned rather than take that very public step of saying, actually, we believe the president should be removed. And that was Education Secretary DeVos and Secretary Chao as well. But I do believe that even if the 25th Amendment isn't invoked, we will be seeing the House move forward with impeachment. And that really will be the battleground that Congress is going to be fighting on for the next week or so.
We're talking to Grace Seegers, political reporter for CBS News. Also with us, Alexandra Jaffe, national political correspondent for the Associated Press, and Ned Foley, director of election law at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Ned, briefly recap the impeachment process for us.
Sure. Two stages. Starts in the House of Representatives, simple majority rule there. So the Democrats in the House clearly have the power to do that. And they've announced a timetable that could, you know, trigger that even before January 20th this week. We often, as Americans, we talk about impeachment as conviction upon impeachment, but that's technically not happened. Impeachment is just like an indictment. It sends over the prosecution to the Senate. We may remember this from last year. President Trump was already impeached by the House, but he was acquitted in the Senate. And so there would need to be a trial on the charges in the Senate, and it takes two-thirds of the Senate to convict. My judgment, and I think of most scholars, is you can have the trial take place, even the impeachment, after President Trump leaves office. It's unusual, but it's because one penalty for a conviction upon impeachment is disqualification for future office. And so I think that's the only thing that we're really focused on now as a practical matter. I don't think impeachment can be used as a substitute for the 25th Amendment like we were talking about before. There just isn't time for that. Impeachment's too cumbersome. Senator McConnell has announced that it couldn't be taken up in the Senate until the 19th at the earliest date. So it's only going to be punitive in that sense. And then the question is it the better vehicle for accountability and punishment, or is the normal process of a criminal trial, you know, appropriate, or both? I mean, they're different penalties, different methodologies, but we're not talking about the immediate danger at that point. We're talking about accountability and punishment.
Well, we got this email from Marilyn who wants to know not just about the president, but about Congress. She writes, if Congress expels a member, can their constituents reelect him or her? What can you tell us about that, Grace?
You know, it is unclear to me, I'm going to be honest. I believe that the member could be elected again, but I'm going to defer to Ned on that one, the constitutional scholar here.
Ned, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Senate, each chamber is the judge of the qualifications, elections, and returns of its own members. The Supreme Court, in a controversial case, has held that the Senate or the House can't impose new qualifications. But believe it or not, there was an impeachment of a sitting senator in the early in American history with the goal for imposing this disqualification punishment. So I do think there is a constitutional mechanism to prevent a member of Congress from ever serving in Congress again. It may require impeachment as well as expulsion.
We got this question on Facebook, and a lot of people are asking about this. John emails Trump, or rather, he emailed us, Trump should fall on his sword, but lacks the honor for that. More importantly than removing him for the next 9 days is removing him from our political future. Is it not possible to do so under the 14th Amendment, Article 3? Ned?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that question.
So John wants to know, is it possible to prevent Trump from being part of our political future under the 14th Amendment, Article 3?
Yeah, people have been looking at the 14th Amendment, and that is one element of that. I would broaden out the question. I do think the key point here is to prevent President Trump from being part of the political conversation, but the question is how that should be done. My own view is that the most healthy way to do that is for the Republican Party to basically excommunicate him and make him a persona non grata within the party. In other words, if the Republican Party heals itself, that's the best way for the whole system to heal. If the Republican Party seems incapable of doing that, then I think Congress institutionally has to kind of prod and help the Republican Party along, either through impeachment or censure, as the senator talked about, and again, maybe criminal prosecution. You wouldn't have to rely on the 14th Amendment to disqualify him from holding office. Some of the statutes involving insurrection and sedition have the same kind of disqualification. So if the goal is to disqualify President Trump from participating in politics, there's definitely a way to do that. The question is, which is the best or the way to go about it?
And just for the sake of clarity, Ned, can you briefly outline what the 14th Amendment says?
Yeah, so the 14th Amendment was a product of this, the Reconstruction during the Civil War, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't have it right in front of me, but it essentially meant if anybody participated in rebellion or insurrection against the United States, that's grounds for never being able to hold office in, the United States government, unless Congress gives a waiver. And the historical genesis of that was figuring out what to do with former Confederates, because the Confederacy was treason against the United States government, the secession and the war, Civil War, and so forth. And so, as part of Reconstruction, well, how are we going to build the country back together? And the premise was that anybody who had participated in rebellion or insurrection was not eligible to serve in Congress or serve in the United States government unless they got, a special permission or some kind of exoneration. So is that a good analogy for where we people have talked about this as the greatest threat since the Civil War, and I share that view. And I think we need a kind of reconstruction of our politics, as we've been talking about. But I don't know that every aspect of the Civil War experience is the perfect analogy for where we are today. I think we have to think that through carefully.
We got this tweet from Don, who says it may be necessary to stall impeachment until the Democrats run the Senate, but it should definitely be pursued. If we don't, we are telling any future president that he or she can do whatever he or she wants without consequences. And Grace, just about a minute here, talk about that particular aspect of this conversation and how Democrats are talking about this balance between moving forward and accountability.
So I do think that there are definitely some differing perspectives here. So the House Majority Whip, Clyburn, just said yesterday that he believed maybe the House should hold off on sending impeachment articles to the Senate until after Biden's first 100 days in office. But then again, there are other members of the House who are saying we need to get this done immediately, even if it interrupts the first few days of Biden's term. So I think there are definitely differing perspectives from members of the House and Senate on this.
We're discussing how Congress is responding to last week's pro-Trump insurrection with Grace Seegers, political reporter for CBS News, Alexandra Jaffe, national political correspondent for the Associated Press, and Ned Foley, director of election law at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Meenakshi tweets, what signal are we sending to the world if we don't take action on Trump? Isn't this going to put us in a bad spot with our foreign affairs? I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. Now let's get back to our conversation about how Congress is responding to last week's pro-Trump insurrection. With us, Grace Seegers, political reporter for CBS News, Alexandra Jaffe, national political correspondent for the Associated Press, and Ned Foley, director of election law at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And here's what some of you had to say about what should happen next.
The legislative branch should move for impeachment, as well as Vice President should move for the 25th Amendment immediately. Time is of the essence. The failure to protect the Capitol and all of its House members is a top-down issue, starting with the president who incited the riot.
I don't want to see absolutely anything. It's ridiculous to think that every single time something like this happens, that you get pushback from citizens, that means the government has to become more authoritarian. That's why we are even in the position we are today.
I would very much like to see the legislature go after the people who are responsible, eject any of the members of the lower or upper house who supported this.
I would like to see Trump out of office with no ability, capability, not even a whisper of a chance of him getting reelected in 24.
Thanks to Rodney, William, Jane, and Danny for sharing your thoughts. Norma also writes on Facebook, this is not about time constraints, it's about principles and accountability. Grace, if impeachment makes it to the Senate before Trump leaves office, what do we know about where Republicans stand in all of this?
So first of all, McConnell has said that the first day that impeachment could potentially be picked up would be on the 19th, which is the very day before President Trump leaves office. So we're talking about an extremely narrow time frame here. But with that in consideration, we have heard from a couple of Republicans who said that they want the president out of office. We heard that from Senators Murkowski and Toomey. Senator Ben Sasse said that he would be willing to consider whatever the House brought forward on any impeachment articles. So we have had a few Republican senators say that they are willing to consider impeachment or having some way the president removed from office. But that's a very small minority, and impeachment, in order for the president to be convicted, that would require a two-thirds vote, which is 67 senators. And I don't believe that you're going to see that many Republican senators go in favor of impeachment, even if privately they believe that the president should resign or should be held accountable in some way.
Well, Monica writes on Facebook, I have been changing my mind about either impeachment or invoking the 25th Amendment. I'm angry, but there's just not enough time to affect either one. Instead, what about censuring the outgoing president? Alexandra, are we hearing anything about that?
Well, right now the conversation is around impeachment and sort of timing around that going forward. And I think whether it's successful is really up to that timing. As Grace mentioned, there's now talk of postponing any sort of action in the Senate until after Joe Biden has the chance to get his agenda sort of moving in his first 100 days. And at that point, it really depends on how much control and hold Donald Trump still has over the Republican Party. I think that there's a lot of appetite actually among Republicans privately to move beyond a president who was the first president in decades to lose both the White House, the Senate, and the House for Republicans all in one election. And so if we continue to see his stature fall within the Republican Party, if he continues to cause problems for Republicans, we may see somewhat of a sea change in Republican sentiment around impeachment and some different opinions coming out when that impeachment proceeding in the Senate actually begins. But again, that depends on whether Democrats are willing and planning to delay it until after Joe Biden's first 100 days.
But Ned, we are getting a lot of questions from people listening to our conversation about censure and what that would mean for the president.
Yes, yeah, so censure is another tool that Congress has. It's a formal official rebuke or condemnation of an individual for, you know, terrible misconduct. It's been applied to a president, Andrew Jackson, back in the 19th century, and it's been applied to senators, Senator Joe McCarthy for McCarthyism. So I think that should be looked at, especially if it's easier to get a bipartisan coalition around the idea that of a formal condemnation. You know, that could be part of a healing process. Again, it doesn't get us through the immediate crisis of between now and January 20th, but it could be part of the accountability equation afterwards.
And is there anything other than it being a strong rebuke, is there any impact of it other than saying what you did was terrible?
No, I mean, that's all it is. And so some people think of it as a slap on the wrist and just symbolic, and you have to decide whether that's meaningful. I mean, I think it has been thought historically because it's been so rarely done. And it's been talked about, you know, after Charlottesville, after President Trump's, you know, what good people on both sides that many of us found, you know, abhorrent and repugnant. You know, I actually advocated censure over that. It did, and there were members of Congress who thought about it, but it didn't go anywhere. So, you know, some people think what happened on Wednesday is way beyond censure, and censure would be way too light a penalty, if you will. But the fact that censure, and here's where differentiation of culpability comes in mind. I mean, the censure might be appropriate. I think the senator referred to censure of her fellow senators, Senators Cruz and Hawley. That might be a calibrated response. The president might need to face more accountability than just censure. But that's why this is going to be an important conversation about exactly how we come to grips with what happened last week.
Yes, and Senator Smith also said she thinks Senators Hawley and Cruz should resign. And some of our listeners agree. Tim from Michigan told us, what I would like to see from Congress is the removal of any congressperson who announced their intention to object to any state's Electoral College votes. Trump's encouragement of his followers to march on the Capitol and take back the government was an act of sedition. And I want to note, we invited Senators Hawley and Cruz on today's show, along with the other 49 sitting Republican senators, and they did not respond. But the invitation stands. Other of their colleagues have called for their ousting for their involvement. Ned, can they be kicked out by their peers?
Yes, it's difficult. It requires a two-thirds vote, the way the conviction of impeachment also does. So it's a high hurdle. So I'm not anticipating that sort of as a practical matter, but it is within Congress's power, each chamber's power. It was, again, used during the time of the Civil War. So yes, that tool is available.
Grace, as we said, Senators Hawley and Cruz voted against confirming Joe Biden's electoral victory, but they weren't the only two lawmakers to do that. 147 lawmakers voted against confirming Joe Biden's win, including Senators Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi, Roger Marshall of Kansas, Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming, Rick Scott of Florida, and John Kennedy of Louisiana. What do we know about why they decided to object after everything that happened at the Capitol? We know other lawmakers changed course.
Well, I was there on Wednesday, and Senator Marshall, who is a new senator, spoke about how he had considered this very strongly in light of everything that had happened on that day. And other senators, in light of what had happened, such as Senator Lankford, had changed their mind about objecting. But I think that for some of these senators who voted in favor, that it really was a matter of principle and a matter of sticking to their word, where they said that they were going to object, and if they suddenly changed their mind, they believed that it would make them look unprincipled. So they wanted to stick to their word on that. The other thing that I would note that is very important here is that we're seeing a bit of a gulf between House Republicans and Senate Republicans, in that a majority of House Republicans vote to object to the Electoral College results, while only a handful of Senate Republicans voted to do so. And I think that you're hearing more private chagrin from Senate Republicans about what occurred on Wednesday, and wanting the president to either resign or take accountability in some form, while more House Republicans are unashamed and accepting of what they did and objecting to their results and genuinely believing that it was the right thing to do. So I do think that there's a bit of an ideological gulf there between the House and Senate Republicans.
What does that say to you about the state of the GOP right now?
I think that there's definitely a lot of division. So something to note about the House is that these members are representing smaller constituencies in their districts. So that sort of allows for more strongly ideological members to be elected, whereas senators represent whole states. So I think that there's definitely a problem within the GOP where some members are very ideological and they have incentives to support President Trump. And as Alexandra was mentioning before, while many Republicans may want to distance themselves from the presidents, for others, it would be bad for them politically if they did so. So I really think that we're going to be seeing over the next few months, once President Trump leaves office, whether he continues to have a hold over the party, particularly in the House.
We're talking to Grace Seegers, political reporter for CBS News, Alexandra Jaffe, national political correspondent for the Associated Press, and Ned Foley, director of election law at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Alexandra, what's been the fallout so far for the president and other Republicans who have stood by him?
Well, it's worth noting that some of the imminent fallout has been political, particularly for those Republicans on Capitol Hill that did support the objections to Joe Biden's win. Ted Cruz's 2016 campaign chair denounced him. Particularly, Josh Hawley has seen some donors basically publicly denounce him and say they won't be supporting him. He also lost his book deal. And former Senator Jack Danforth, who's been a mentor of his, said that supporting him was the worst mistake I ever made in my life. So, you know, both Ted Cruz and Hawley, it's worth mentioning, are senators with 2024 ambitions. They're both considering presidential runs. And so I think that in supporting this objection, they made a gamble thinking that, you know, the sort of Trump base of the GOP will have as much sway within the party in 2024. And that's the voters they're going to need to court as they're trying to navigate through that Republican primary. But now that there's been such a sea change, and we've seen donors sort of saying, I'm not going to support these folks anymore. Some Republicans have said, you know, this is going to make their presidential bids tougher. It's tough to say whether it was the right political move and whether they made the right gamble. I mean, I think the Republican Party is going to change quite a bit in the next 4 years. And so we'll see whether the Trump base is still as significant and these moves won them some support.
Well, the president has been kicked off of all major social media platforms, and Amazon effectively shut down Parler. That's a favorite platform of the right wing by refusing to host the website on its servers. Alexander, what's been the president's reaction? Do we even know?
It's tough to say when he doesn't have, you know, Twitter right in front of him to fire off his thoughts. But, you know, folks close to him have indicated that he's completely incensed by being kicked off of those social media platforms, frustrated that he can't just send off a tweet and sort of lead headlines and cable news. So he's spent quite a bit of time stewing. We do know that he has not been talking to Vice President Pence. He didn't check in on him during the events Wednesday at the Capitol and has basically shut him out of his operations. Though this week we do expect him to reemerge. There's talk that he may give remarks today, sort of talking about some of his accomplishments and again denouncing those social media companies. We've heard that he's going to spend some of his time whenever he does speak publicly attacking social media companies. And he'll also be heading to the border tomorrow again to talk about immigration and sort of the border wall, one of what he and his allies see as his signature accomplishments. So in the final sort of week of his presidency, there's been a lot of pressure on him from aides to refocus on talking about those accomplishments and not this controversy of the past week to help him move beyond that. But as we've seen again and again from President Trump, he has a tough time of sticking to the message. So we'll see what he has to say.
Well, Ned, I want to wrap on these two messages we got. Jason tweets, in the spirit of bipartisanship, the more talk of impeachment and punishment of Trump, the more it alienates the 70 plus million Americans who voted for him. And Carol emails, people with faith in Congress have witnessed abuse after abuse of power in this administration. If Congress fails to hold anyone responsible for their role in their assault on our democracy, including the president and members of Congress, Congress, more people will lose their faith in our government. So two very different views. But in the next 30 seconds, tell me what you think this means for the health of our democracy at this moment.
Well, I think you're right to focus on those two, and it captures it exactly. I think the big question is, can we avoid if Trump 2.0, if we could call it that? I mean, I think that's the goal here. Trumpianism is a pathology, a cancer on a fair system of democracy. And we saw last Wednesday just what a threat it is. So the guiding principle is, how do we get, you know, eliminate that threat? It's possible that overreaction in terms of punishment might make it worse, make a martyr and make Trump 2.0 more of a force. That would be bad. On the other hand, if you don't address it, you might let it also metastasize. So I think we know the right goal, how to get there. That's a big challenge.
That's Ned Foley. He's the director of election law at The Ohio State University. He's also author of Ballot Battles. Also with us today, Grace Seegers. She's a political correspondent for CBS News. She was at the Capitol last Wednesday. And Alexandra Jaffe. She's a national political correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.